Hei! Husk at rådene I Skallebank generelle og ikke tilpasset deg. Hvert tilfelle unikt.
Derfor anbefaler vi at alle med hjernerystelse eller mistanke om det oppsøker kompetent helsepersonell for en individuell vurdering. Her kommer episoden. Hei, og velkommen til Skallebank. Podcasten om hjernerystelse. Jeg heter Lars Martin Fischer.
Og jeg heter Narve Bjørneseth. Og I dag så har vi vårt første internasjonale intervju.
Ja, vi var så heldige å få snakke med Graham Cochrane.
Ja.
Han har forsket på hjernerystelse, blant annet.
Ja, han lege og... Nei, det feil. Han PhD-student og lege under utdanning. Og han har da I løpet av dette studieløpet sitt forsket på hva svimmelhet, hvordan du kan teste svimmelhet hos hjernerystelsespasienter,
ja.
Og hva det egentlig har å si. Hva det som gjør deg svimmel, sagt veldig enkelt. Det noen ting som skiller seg ut?
Ja, også litt sånn om man kan bruke svimmelhetstester for å øke mistanken til at noen har hjernerystelse eller ei.
Ja, som et diagnostisk verktøy, rett og slett.
Mm-hmm.
Veldig, veldig spennende. Og så hadde han noen veiledere som jobbet med MS, så da måtte han begynne å forske på det også. Så da endte han opp med å finne ut veldig mye rundt betydningen av svimmelhet og fatigue hos MS-pasienter. Intervjuet vårt nå, det kommer til å foregå på engelsk, for ja. Graham var ikke kjempegod I norsk.
Nei, altså der det jo en del ord og uttrykk som kanskje ikke så kjent for alle.
Nei.
Men vet du hva dere kan gjøre? Dere kan bare skrive inn til oss, eller på... dere kan bare skrive inn... Enten en mail til oss, eller gjerne post på Instagram-siden hvis dere lurer på noen ord og begreper.
Ja.
Så skal vi gjerne ta og rydde litt opp I det.
Ja, for dette ganske vanskelig. Det vanskelig for veldig, veldig mange. Vanskelig for klinikere, og da det garantert vanskelig for pasienter også. Men intervjuet I boks, og hvis du fortsetter å høre på, så får du lov å høre på det også. Så, have a great one, guys. Here is the interview. Hi, we're here with Graham Cochrane. Who are you, Graham?
Hey, I'm Graham Cochrane. I'm an MD-PhD student at the University of Alabama at Birmingham in Alabama, one of the states in the U.S., I just recently finished my PhD in rehabilitation science and have returned to medical school to finish up my medical degree in one of the NIH MD-PhD funded programs. So excited to talk about some of my research in vestibular function, concussion, and MS here with you guys today.
Cool.
Yeah, that's really cool.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, it's great. You're our first international guest, so...
I'm really honored. I'm sorry. We have to do this in English.
No, I don't mind. I think it would be worse in Norwegian. So it's probably all right.
It would certainly be worse in Norwegian.
But you're a doctor now, and you're training to be a medical doctor. What specialty are you training in?
Yeah. So it's been really confusing being working in the hospital and being a doctor because I haven't been telling anyone that because it gets a little confusing. So originally my plan was to go into neurology. But as I started presenting my research and getting to know other people in the vestibular research and clinical worlds, I got more interested in otolaryngology and doing either neuro-otology or pediatric ENT down the road. Was really interested in some of the kind of combinations between surgical intervention and clinical management of vestibular disorders and think that otolaryngology would give me a little bit more breadth of training to intervene in my patients down the road.
Yeah.
So that's where I'm leaning right now.
Cool. Yeah, because that's a weird thing in medicine where they say that the neurologist, he knows all the nerves except cranial nerve number 8, and that's the ear. And that's absolutely where the ENT or the otolaryngologist comes in to help the neurologist with all the dissipations.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. When I've been kind of explaining my research to people, everyone's like, "Oh, you're doing neurology then?" And all the neurologists are like, "Oh, so you're doing ENT then?" Because they know that they don't manage the dizzy patients, but everyone on the outside seems to think that would be what neurology does.
Yeah. I had a patient today that was treated by she had a massive trauma, and then she was treated by the orthopedic doctor, and she really didn't understand why. And then I had to explain her, if you break your bones, it doesn't matter what happens to the brain. You're still ending up in the orthopedic department.
Yep. Somehow still end up there.
Yeah.
Yeah. So how many years do you spend doing research?
For doing research?
Yeah.
So the typical pathway for the MSTP, which is the Medical Scientist Training Program, which is funded by the NIH, it's typically about 8 years total. So you do 4 years of medical school and 4 years of a PhD, and putting quotation marks around that.
Yeah, yeah.
Because you do graduate school courses during your medical school training, and also do rotations in labs. So basically, by the time you start your full-time PhD work, you're already like a second year PhD student. So it really ends up kind of being like 5 or 6 years of research to get your PhD.
Right.
But you're only full time in the PhD for about 4 years. And that varies. That can go from anywhere to like from 3 full-time years to 6 full-time years. But the average is a total of 8 for the program.
Right. And then after that, you have to finish your medical degree, or is that part of the 8 years?
Yeah, so you do the first 2 years of medical school in the U.S. That's all your preclinical, like lectures and learning kind of the basic science of medicine. And then you do those 2 years, you take your first board exam, go off to do your PhD, and then you come back and do the 3rd and 4th years of medical school, which are all the clinical, when you're actually going into the hospital, rotating on different services and trying to figure out what you want to do clinically. So that's what I'm in right now.
Right. Okay, cool. But let's start with the PhD. I found you on Twitter. So yep, that's how we met. Yay, Twitter, social media. It connects people.
It's fantastic for this. It really is.
Yeah, for research. I met so many researchers on Twitter. So yep, I highly recommend it to everyone I meet. And it's the only sphere where everybody's nice. There's no...
For the most part.
Yeah. Well, I haven't seen any beef yet, but it's bound to come up at times.
The first couple months, I had to block a few concussion people. Because there's some nasty arguments that go on between some folks on Twitter surrounding concussion and research.
Yeah, because it's a difficult field, isn't it? It's quite new. Even though we've talked about concussion for how many years now? 40?
Like
forever.
Even longer than that, in like the early 1900s with boxing. But people like to pretend that research never really existed.
Yeah. The punch drunk boxing papers. Yeah.
Totally different thing. We didn't know this was a big deal at all.
No. They lost their teeth, but their brain was fine. Yeah. All right. But then your papers, your PhD, it started about what exactly?
So originally when I joined the MSTP or MD-PhD program, most people who go that route end up doing a basic science. And so I had done a lot of concussion research in undergrad, sort of clinical, working with our athletes and clubs, interdisciplinary sports, intramural sports, trying to just do some balance testing, some cognitive testing. I really enjoyed that. It's what got me into the research world to begin with.
Okay.
When I came to UAB, I tried to work in a basic science lab with like cell lines and mouse models, and the first mouse I ever picked up bit me under my thumbnail, and it was awful. I immediately knew that I needed to go back to human research, and so I reached out. The lab I ended up working with for my PhD had just opened the year that I started at UAB. It didn't exist beforehand. Okay. And they had just gotten a rotary chair to assess different vestibular and ocular motor biomarkers for concussion.
Right.
And so I reached out to them. I said, hey, I'm a student. I have a little bit of background in concussion research. I had kind of thought about the vestibular system before because we did some balance function right. testing, but it really wasn't the focus of my previous research. And I joined them. And so our first goal was really to look at both kids and young adults, like college age students, through rotary chair eye tracing measures who had concussion to determine if we could find any objective vestibular measures from that system, along with doing some VEMPs, the vestibular myogenic potentials, and balance testing as well.
Right. I should probably explain to our audience that rotatory chair, why is that good? In your ear, in your balance organ, that's what makes you feel if you spin. So it's moving your eyes when you're spinning your body. So by looking at your eyes while we spin you around in a chair, that gives us information how the brain works and how the vestibular system works. Okay. And a VEMP, that's basically a myogenic potential. That's you give a stimulus somewhere on the body, and then you read out what it does with the muscle, if it's twitching right. Okay.
If it makes your audience feel any better, very few of us actually understand what it is, but we know we can measure it.
right. There's a lot of that in research, isn't it? We're just doing stuff. Okay. So, and all this research that you did, it turned into published papers, right?
Yeah, we were very fortunate to get some good data out of it. Eventually, we decided to split up our sample. There was all under the same study. We did the same stuff in the kids and young adults, but we started getting like a ton of college level athletes in, because we partnered with our football team and our women's soccer team, and we felt like they weren't really the same kind of athletes as like 12-year-olds playing soccer for the first time.
No.
In their their local community. So while we're doing the same testing on them, we decided to split up the populations for analyses. And that's why we have a couple of different papers out on this research.
Right. Because you have one on kids and you have one on regular athletes and concussed athletes. Yeah.
Yeah. We ended up having there's two on the college athletes, but we just split that up. So we did ocular motor, so looking at eye movement specifically, so without using the vestibular system. We still tested them in the rotary chair, but they were stationary, and we did a lot of eye movement tests. That was its own paper. Okay. And then sort of the vestibular focus, looking at when we actually moved the rotary chair and looked at balance function, was the other study. For the kids, though, we just combined them because there wasn't much to talk about in terms of the actual data findings. There's some clinical implications of that, but there's less to actually present from the data point of view.
Okay. So what did you find out exactly from these papers?
Sure. So sort of the more exciting stuff, I guess, was in the college athletes, and we'll talk about why that was, I'm sure.
Yeah.
So looking at our different vestibular tests, so like you were saying, we have that rotary chair that looks at eye movements when your head spins around from your vestibular system. And that's a vestibular reflex, the vestibular ocular reflex. So even though we test our participants in complete darkness, their eyes will still move when their head spins, just for your listeners here.
Yeah.
So we can measure how well the vestibular system is communicating with the eye muscles.
Right.
And we found that in our athletes with concussion, that function was actually working well. The eyes were responding properly to movement. And therefore, we thought that this reflex from the vestibular organ was intact. And then on the VEMPs, which again, we don't really know what they do, but we know how to measure them. And we know they're a reflex from a different part of the vestibular organ. Looking at those, we found that in our athletes with concussion, they essentially had normal VEMPs or vestibular reflexes in that test as well. Yeah. So it looked like the reflexes from the vestibular system were working properly. So there was no real damage to the organ itself or cranial nerve 8 or the vestibular cochlear nerve or auditory nerve, whatever you want to call it, that brings information into the brainstem from the vestibular organ.
Right.
But then when we looked at some like higher level vestibular processes, one of those being the most obvious, those being balance. So balance uses vestibular information, but it also uses your vision. It uses the muscles in your legs. Your balance gets worse if your eyes are closed, right?
Yeah.
Or if your surface is unstable. So the vestibular system works with multiple other systems. That was still decreased. Our athletes with concussion had poor balance.
Yeah.
And they also had poor subjective visual vertical, which is something that not a lot of people test. But people use all the time in real life. So it's essentially your ability to tell whether something is straight or not, which is like if you're trying to put a picture up on the wall and you're trying to decide if you put the picture up straight, that's your perception of vertical. Yeah. And our athletes with concussion had abnormal perception of vertical.
But from the way I understood it, the finding wasn't necessary that that they had an impaired subjective visual vertical, but also that the results varied a lot from test to test. Is that correct? So there was a much bigger variation in the subjects themselves.
Absolutely. So typically when you do subjective visual vertical or SVV, you want to see sort of what the person thinks vertical is. So if you have damage to one of your vestibular organs, either in your left or right ear, you'll typically tilt your perception of vertical towards that side over time. So instead of being perfectly straight, if you damage your left organ, your perception of vertical will actually be tilted slightly to the left. And we found that in our athletes with concussion, they weren't tilted necessarily one way or the other, which is typically what you look at for the measure, but they had a huge variance in response. So we did it 6 times for each person. So for instance, somebody might be perfectly straight once and then be tilted to the left. And then the next time we test them, they're tilted to the right. And then they're tilted to the right again. And then they're perfectly straight. So they weren't tilting one way or the other. They just were very variable in their response, which we did not see a lot of previous research looking at. But I'm hoping other people do look at that measure. I think it's a measure of central function.
Right.
Do they vary within the same hour, or is it you test them on different occasions?
That's a great question. So we have some data on this. We tried to do a sideline test using the bucket test for SVV, which some people might be aware of. Basically, you put the participant's or patient's face in a plastic bucket that has a line drawn on the bottom of it, and you tell them to tell you when the line is straight. And so we actually brought one of those into some of our football games for our football team and tried to see guys get taken off the sideline for concussion evaluation. And we did the SVV using the bucket. Could we see any deficits? And then we followed them for a couple of days afterwards, doing the bucket every day for 2 weeks. And we found that directly after the concussions, like as they pulled off the field to get, you know, assessed, their SVV was fine, but the next day it started increasing in variance. And as their concussion resolved, the variance went back to normal.
Okay. So it kind of looks like all other symptoms with concussion, it increases during the first week, basically.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So it was basically that first day we saw this huge variance, and it slowly went down over time.
Right.
For the SVV. We don't have, we got like four people's worth of data for that, so we never published it.
No.
But subjectively, I can tell you that happened.
Yeah. All right. So, but were there published papers on vestibular agnosia before your paper on this SVV finding?
So people have looked at it before, but in really, really specific, very different populations from concussion, right? So people have looked at SVV in people with stroke, some people with Parkinson's disease, so pretty different pathologies. No one, as far as we're aware, had looked at SVV ever in concussion.
Right.
And the only reason we did it was because our rotary chair did it and we thought it was cool. really, for the majority of our data collection, we thought it wasn't showing us anything, because the average, when we ran like preliminary analyses, the averages were the same. We're like, oh, it's not useful. And then I had one participant who had just, I watched him do it and I could tell he was all over the place. So we started looking at variants. Yeah. Not that I know of. There wasn't a lot. There definitely wasn't a lot on variance in response.
No.
People have tried to look at the direction of tilt based on where you have a stroke in the brain. And that's pretty different from the diffuse damage we think happens in concussion.
Right.
So vestibular agnosia, is it a defined term now? Is it just related to the SVV or... are there other aspects about the vestibular system that gets affected?
I'm actually not as familiar with the term. I've heard the term used before, and that's when it came up a lot in those. Yeah. So I don't know if y'all have a little bit more.
No, it's that when they talk about vestibular agnosia, they from what I understand is that they try to basically talk about that you're dizzy after a concussion. But we know that your end organ is fine, also based on your research. And then what vestibular agnosia as a theory tries to explain is that you have a mess up of the central signals of the vestibular information. But when I explain it to doctors here in Norway, most people are not familiar with the term yet. But again, the people I talk to on social media and on Twitter, it's a very biased population with we tend to be nerdy about vestibular research and dizziness, right, and everything that makes people spin. So right, in that subgroup, most people know of it.
And I'd say, especially, I mean, I'm biased with my data. And I think the thing that got a lot of people excited about what we showed is we showed that exactly that what you're saying. So the organ is intact. There's no damage. It can happen. It didn't happen in our population. You can actually have damage to the vestibular end organ after head injury.
Yeah.
But not as commonly and just sort of all comers.
No.
So the organ's fine. The reflexes are fine. So signals are being sent to the brainstem properly. But we still see we still see deficits in vestibular functions. So it has to be happening somewhere else in the brain. And that's, I think it's this central integration of vestibular information that
right,
really breaks down after a concussion.
Yeah. And it also, in my mind, it supports the fact that, well, everybody in pain research and everybody in vestibular research are still looking for the holy grail, that like one point in the brain that's responsible for everything happening. And the more we look, it turns out it's lots of different centers working in coordination. Right. So it's, well, vestibular agnosia and your findings, it tries to explain that it's probably that communication that's messed up, right, not the end organ like itself.
Right, it's a network system level error. That's why, similarly, and I'm biased about these because I've done some of these studies. So the people looking at like pupillary light reflex after a concussion is like the measure. It's like the region of the brain that would have to be damaged for that to be the only thing that you can measure is like this little tiny nucleus in your brainstem that is surrounded by other things that if you damaged, you would probably die.
Yeah.
So I just people trying to find these very specific lesions after concussion. I don't understand why that's still the focus.
No, it's a bit weird, but probably will as knowledge increases, we'll go away from the theory that one place, one function, and we'll start to think more and more of the brain as a sub-network of lots of things working together right. at the same time to accomplish many very complex calculations and tasks.
Everyone wants it to be like stroke.
Yeah, it's not. It's not. No. All right.
So could we use the SVV for diagnosing a concussed player, do you think?
So
if you have a baseline,
I don't have published data to tell you that. I can tell you that in my sample of, I think it was like 30, if I included the kids in there too, which I shouldn't have done because we split it up, but just using SVV variants was, I think, 80% sensitive for concussion.
That's which is pretty high. Good. Yeah.
Pretty good compared to other things that we do. Yeah. And that was just doing 6 trials. That's without any sort of, you know, making sure kids do the test properly or making sure we're doing the right number of trials or at the right time. Just randomly, it was 80% sensitive in our data.
Right. So it's basically an argument to put it into your set of tests if you want to diagnose a concussion.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And not that they really use... So, our athletic training staff would ask me after I tested them what their SVVs were, just because everyone's looking for just a little bit more information to make the right decision. They weren't basing any like treatment decisions off whether or not their SVV was impaired. No. But if they're like on the fence about this person seems like they're doing better, but still get a little symptomatic while they're exercising, their balance is maybe a little bit off, their SVD's off too. Oh, well, they've got other things going on. We don't need to send them back right now.
Yeah.
You know,
very cool.
Yeah, so it could be an add-on to the return to play decision, basically.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I mean,
and you definitely need baseline data for it because some people are just bad at the test and have high variance to begin with.
Yeah,
But
that was my other question.
They're not that bad. So
how does the unconcussed players rate? Is it big variance there as well?
No, so that's a great question. So that's another reason we split up our data by college age and the kids. So if you look at our data on the rotary chair test, which is a little bit better than doing it with the bucket, only a little bit better though. Yeah. It is better. The median variance in response over 6 trials was 1 degree, which is very small. And like the 95th or the 90th percentile was like 2 degrees off, which is still pretty small variance in response.
Mm-hmm.
The median response for all of our concussions was like 1.6, 1.7. So they were almost on average, basically, above the 90th percentile of our healthy controls. So it's a pretty substantial difference.
Yeah.
The problem is the variance is not a nice normally distributed variable. So you'll have people who have a variance of like 1 degree and then people with concussion who have a variance of like 95. So it makes doing statistics a little bit harder, but it's not impossible.
No. Okay. So that's that paper in regards to the testing. Then the papers on the kids, they were also spun around in the rotatory chair and they did the SVV. Yep. What did you find there?
Yeah. So we did the exact same protocol on the kids. Did rotary chair, did balance testing, and did those VEMPs. And basically what we found was when we compared kids with concussion to kids without concussion, we didn't see any differences. There were a few like statistically significant differences, but after you correct for the number of analyses we were doing, which we were testing a lot of clinical tests, so doing a lot of statistical analyses, something's bound to pop up.
Right.
After correcting for those, there were no significant differences between our kids with concussion and kids without concussion. And subjectively, as we were doing the study, we were kind of keeping notes on how well kids did on these tests. So the rotary chair is a great clinical tool that is used in adults a lot. For most of our kids, we had to put them on a booster seat while they were in the chair so they could actually have their head properly put in the chair with the goggles on.
Right.
And there hasn't been a lot of data on how kids do on subjective vertical. So we found that kids were kind of struggling with these tests. We had to train them a lot more on how to do the SVV, like trying to explain what the test was actually doing. Especially we had kids who are as young as like 7 and 8 doing it. So it's hard to tell them to make a line perfectly straight. It's boring. It's not fun. They've already been spinning around for half an hour. And then the balance test, if any of your listeners are familiar with the sensory organization test or the SOT,
yeah,
it's kind of fun because if you wobble around, if you sway back and forth, you can get the walls to move and you can get the floor to move underneath you. And so while we tell them to stand perfectly still, some of them like that they can control walls with their movement. And so they were kind of playing with it as we were trying to collect their data on their balance function.
Yeah.
So we have healthy controls. If you look at our data, our kids with concussion actually did better on our SOT measures than our healthy controls. And we think that's just because the controls were just having a good time playing with it, and not that kids with concussion actually have better balance. So then we did a second analysis where we took just the healthy kids and we split them up. Our age range was 8 to 17. Mm-hmm. So we split them up 8 to 12 year olds and compared them to 13 to 17 year olds. And we didn't really have the sample size to do this, but sort of the trends of the data suggest that on most of the SOT measures, on the subjective visual vertical, the younger kids did far worse than the older kids, even like splitting them up by those age ranges, where a lot of the data suggests your vestibular system is mature by age 7 or 8. It still doesn't matter if you're not mature enough to do the test.
Right.
And so we found that kids might not be the most reliable on these measures, which might mean we need to tailor them better to kids. We definitely need more higher sample sizes at different ages to determine if we're going to use these for cutoffs. What cutoffs would you expect at different ages? I don't think the mechanism is any different. I think you could still see subtle evidence of balance impairment and SVV differences that didn't quite meet that statistical threshold. But when you throw in all the sort of variables around it, it was harder to detect differences after concussion in the kids.
Right, right. So what did we learn except that kids are hard to handle in the lab?
I mean, that's important to know to begin with, though, right? Like all of our vestibular data is based off of adults that we use for kids.
Yeah.
And I think the really important thing that we learned from, so to kind of back up a little bit.
Yeah.
For our athlete data, those were just any concussion that happened at UAB on the football team or the soccer team came to our lab.
Okay.
It didn't matter what their symptoms were. They had a concussion and they agreed to. They came to our lab. The kids in our study were only kids with dizziness, prolonged dizziness symptoms, or, you know, balance impairments, walking difficulties, because they went through a different clinic before they reached our lab. So the clinic saw them first, you know, mostly like a month after their injury by the time you reach a specialty concussion clinic. And then they said, oh, you should go do this study that's looking at balance function. And so the kids in our study should have had vestibular deficits if we're going to find anything. But we knew that they had dizziness, imbalance, motion sickness, things like that. And so I think what our data really shows is that if you have a kid with all these symptoms, you might not need to find some objective reason why they have these symptoms, and you should just focus on treating their symptoms,
right,
and not proving that they have vestibular deficits.
Yeah, it doesn't really help your decision at all. It's just listen to the kid and what they say.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's a really important thing that a lot of people are missing in the concussion world.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's kids and that's athletes. Were all these kids also doing sports, or was it so they got concussed on the field as well, or?
So we made a definition, and so they were all, quote, active in participation of organized sport.
Right.
So these were kids who could have just been playing their first season of soccer ever and gotten a concussion, but they were a part of an organized sport and not just like playing around in the backyard getting a concussion. And
right,
their concussion was a part of their participation in sport.
For our listeners again, flag football, all these kids aged 8 to 12, when are you start tackling in American football now?
It depends on the state that you're in. I actually don't know the rules.
Right, right.
Yeah.
So in Alabama,
states like where I am, really don't like that plan.
Okay.
The southern states are really big into their football. So.
Right. So they want to rough up the kids as soon as possible.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. That's good.
Got to get them into a good college team.
Yeah. That's but a whole different story.
I think it's mainly around 12 or older.
Right.
Is when contact starts. I think that's a fair number to look at.
Yeah, I think so too. Because in at least the rule in ice hockey here in Norway is that they when they're age below 12, they or when they're in age group under 12, they can start to tackle. Before that, they're not allowed to tackle.
Yeah,
I don't know how it is with American football here. It's not that big as in the States, so I'm really not sure.
No, but you have some no heading rules in soccer as well. Is that correct? How far up that goes?
That's something that again it differs where you are, but the no heading rules, like they really focus even at the college level too, and like high school level, they limit the number of times they can do heading drills too.
Right. So they try to limit the contact with the ball and the head, basically.
Right. Yeah.
Okay. So we got the kids' papers, and then we got the balance papers, and then what else?
On the concussion side?
No, on everything, because you also did studies on MS, right?
Yeah. So we found out that. Or we hypothesized that we had this central vestibular integration problem in people with concussion, where there's some problem process of the brain processing vestibular information. And I was really going to focus my whole PhD thesis on this idea and try to figure out how I was going to measure that. I was going to spin them in the rotary chair while they wore an EEG cap and try to measure vestibular responses in the cortex of people who were concussed and people who weren't. It was a beautiful study that probably wasn't going to work, but it sounded really cool. And I was presenting this idea to my thesis committee, and one of the people on my committee, Rob Model, who's a really big name in multiple sclerosis research, particularly exercise intervention in multiple sclerosis. He was on my thesis committee and he pulled me aside after my presentation on the data. And he was like, there's a group who just did a study of vestibular rehab in people with MS. And they think that there's a problem with central vestibular integration in people with MS as well. And not only that, they think it's related to fatigue in MS. And fatigue is sort of the hallmark, like debilitating symptom of MS that I think 95% of people with MS say it's their worst symptom.
Yeah.
And he said, if you think you have a way to measure central vestibular integration, we should see if we think that it's related to fatigue as well. And so the previous studies have been done by Dr. Hebert at University of Colorado, and they had only used the SOT, which is a great test. It's the test of balance, but they used that. They said, central vestibular integration, SOT, is related to fatigue. And while I believe them, there's a lot of other things that go into that, because he didn't test any peripheral vestibular function or any other different things that could be going wrong with the vestibular system. And so we did a study basically testing every single clinical test you could want to do of vestibular function in people with MS, and looked at which ones were related to self-reported fatigue. So we gave them a survey asking how fatigued they were. And then we also did objective physical fatigue through a 6-minute walk test, where basically you measure how far somebody walks in 6 minutes. And that's a measure of walking capacity and or physical fatigue. And we found that none of our vestibular reflexes were related to fatigue in people with MS. And very rarely were they even impaired in people with MS, which makes sense if you know about MS, but a lot of people have shown previously that some peripheral damage happens sometimes in MS.
Yeah.
But all of our central vestibular measures, so balance function, we also did a functional gait assessment as dynamic balance, and SVV were all correlated with their perceptions of their fatigue.
Okay. Interesting.
Yeah. And so basically we think that this sensory integration process that's sort of breaking down in people with MS is related to sort of the central fatigue, the central nervous system fatigue that they feel.
Yeah. And you also found that it impaired their cognitive function as well. So their fatigue correlated to how well they were thinking, basically.
Exactly. Yeah. So one of the grad students of the PI I was working with, Rob Model, they had like in 2012 showed that balance function was related to processing speed. And nobody had ever followed up on that finding. Nobody had like ever cited their paper for that finding, and just sort of a side finding that they had. And so since we're pulling all these people in to do all these vestibular tests, we said, why don't we just test their cognition too and follow up on this study from, you know, 8 years ago.
Yeah.
And we found that the central vestibular functions, each one was significantly correlated with verbal memory, visual spatial memory, and visual processing speed. So not only was it related to their fatigue and how sort of cognitively or physically fatigued they felt, we could actually measure objective correlations with actual cognitive functioning. And we did an additional analysis where we controlled for their MS severity, because we thought, well, maybe all these things just get worse over the course of MS. And they're not actually related to each other. They're just all associated with MS severity. But even controlling for MS disease severity, there are these huge correlations between vestibular function and cognition.
All right. But then did you also see if you could improve on this function with vestibular training?
That's a great question. So for your PhD, you can't do clinical interventions.
Why not?
For the NIH. Yeah, it's a great question. So, I mean, that's probably an unfair statement. So there's a thing called a F30 fellowship, right, which we're required to apply for by the NIH. So basically, we're in an NIH-funded program. We have to attempt to get these fellowship grants just as training for submitting our own grants in the future.
Mm-hmm.
And for some reason, they can't be clinical trials for a PhD student. Like, it's not allowed. You can't submit a grant on a clinical trial, no matter who you're working with. And so we really focused on, we would have liked to do a little pilot trial, but we really focused on the cross-sectional data. Okay. I would love to do that study.
Yeah.
And I think that's the obvious next step for the people I was working with, but now I'm in medical school, so
yeah.
I can't.
Yeah. No, exactly.
So you don't know if there's anyone looking into that possibility to...
It has been.
Yeah.
It has been a yes. few years ago. I don't remember if it's 10 or 15 years ago. They did a study where they compared patients with dizziness and fatigue. And they had they tried to improve their physical function to see if that improved their fatigue, and nothing happened. And then they went through a vestibular rehab protocol and their fatigue improved. So yep. We have data already that suggests that if you train the function that's lacking, it seems to decrease the fatigue and increase cognitive function.
Yeah, definitely. So Dr. Hebert's paper, I think it was in 2012 or 2014, one of those. Yeah. It might be the study you're thinking of, or there might be another one related. There's been a lot of studies that have started looking at fatigue with vestibular rehabilitation. But one of those studies showed that they compared them to like exercise control group and showed that if you did exercise, it didn't improve fatigue, but something about the vestibular training exercises was related to balance improvement and fatigue improvement.
Yeah.
I don't know if there's been a cognitive one in MS, but there have been studies of vestibular rehab in older adults that show improvements in cognition.
Yeah.
So the data's out there and it's suggesting that there's a relationship. We just need to throw it all together into one study. And it's not hard to measure fatigue at all.
No. No, it's not. All right. But then this MS study, can because fatigue and cognitive impairment is also a huge part of concussion. Can we bring that data back, and can that help us in Concussion somehow?
So that's something I really wish we had done a better job of recording when in our concussion study, because a lot of those post-concussion tools have questions about fatigue severity or cognition, for that matter. But they don't really ask about fatigue that many ways. There's like one little part that says, do you think you're more fatigued? Yeah. I think it would be super easy to just take a study that's already out there that measured like post-concussion symptoms and balance and see whether the fatigue scores are correlated with balance function. Because I don't want to get like super conspiracy theory here, but I think they're the exact same process with this impairment and sensory integration, that it's related to fatigue and cognition MS. I would suspect it's related to fatigue and cognition and concussion as well, because those are all things that we see after concussion.
Yeah. Well, in my book, but I'm a weird guy, in my book, I think if you look at the neurological development of the fetus and what's done first and what comes after and how the vestibular system plays and a very massive role in development and in how you learn how to move, it's weird if it shouldn't be connected to cognition, you know?
Right.
And
absolutely.
And then again, if it's weird if you have you've been working on controlling your body in an automatic fashion for so many years, and then all of a sudden it doesn't work. That's weird that that doesn't affect your energy.
Right.
Yeah.
It makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
And a lot of the studies, you know, we were talking about people trying to localize things in the brain. Everyone gets frustrated that there's no vestibular cortex.
Yeah.
Like, look, the vestibular system's connected to everything. We can't do anything with that. And I think that's outrageously important.
Yeah.
Like, there's no just visual cortex. The vestibular system lights up everything in the brain because it's connected to so many different processes.
Yeah. And still, I think it was 2 or 3 days ago, it was published a study that looked at if we know that kids with hearing impairments, that around 50% of them also have a vestibular deficit, but we don't test them for it. So if you come in with a hearing impairment, we never test your balance function. We never test your vestibular function. And then we wonder why development takes longer time, why they're worse at locomotive tasks. It's strange.
You set me up really well. So my mentor, Jennifer Christie, she's a PT PhD, and she focuses on all of her work has been focused on pediatric vestibular rehab. And she's she's having a grant reviewed right now to do vestibular testing in kids with cochlear implants through Children's of Alabama that I'm helping her write, because we're really interested in that idea as well.
And awesome. That's great.
Seeing sort of, you know, what clinical tests should we be doing in these kids, which ones look abnormal commonly, and also if we find kids with these deficits, can we do vestibular rehab for them to improve them?
Yeah.
Because it makes sense that the pathologies that lead to hearing loss very easily can damage vestibular hair cells or the vestibular apparatus. But it makes sense that they're intrinsically connected, and it's definitely something that's been really ignored for a while. I think we talked about this recently. I think it's been ignored, one reason, because people who do cochlear implants were like thinking that physical therapists were saying that the cochlear implants were causing vestibular dysfunction. And so the people doing the surgeries were like, no, it's not doing that. We don't need to study this. But it's really the reason, the cause of the hearing loss also causes vestibular deficits, not the cochlear implant itself.
No. It's not the surgery messing things up, even though it's a tiny area and they need to be really accurate.
Right. Yeah. I've seen a few of those. So that's what I'm hoping I can get into that kind of surgical field. I think that'd be really fascinating.
Yeah. Sounds great. We both hope to attend. We have connections with the hospitals here in Norway, so we both hope to attend the cochlear implant surgery at one point in time. Yeah. You know, I'm working with the patients from the outside. I would like to look on them from the inside. It's a different thing.
Actually, seeing the semicircular canals is really cool.
Yeah.
I was like, wow, I've been studying these for 6 years. They actually exist.
All right. Is there anything else we should add? Anything that you feel we haven't spoken about yet?
I think in kids, I just want to emphasize. So one of my like most important interactions during my PhD was with this like 16-year-old semi-professional ballerina who had the best vestibular function I've ever tested in my life. But she had a concussion and she felt off balance. She said she was falling into walls and she just felt dizzy. No one was giving her the time of day. And just really emphasizing that you need to listen to your patients and people with these symptoms, because this girl looked fantastic on all of our objective measures, but she was also like a professional ballerina. So she's going to have an incredible vestibular system at baseline. And I did my tests on her and I showed her some objective measures that actually were impaired. And she and her mom both just cried because I showed them her reaction time was off. And I thought it was the weirdest thing, but they had just been kicked around to clinicians saying, oh no, you're fine. Your balance is fine. You're not off balance. You're not dizzy. You're making it up. And just showing them that there was something going on that they really couldn't measure because our clinical tools aren't capable of measuring it for this particular patient.
Right. So how do you think this, everything that we've been talking about now, will it turn into a better test battery for the concussed patients or better tools? Or do we already have the tools? We just need to use it more.
Yeah, exactly. It's a great question because everyone sees our fancy rotary chair system like, oh, wow, I need one of those to test for concussion. And I don't think that's true at all. Mm-hmm. I don't think you need to do these fancy things in every patient who comes around. I think these tools are really good for learning sort of the mechanisms behind what might be happening. But we don't need clinicians to be doing these things. We should just be going with just simple balance measures, symptom reports, hopefully getting better at getting people to really report their symptoms instead of lying about it, and just using just more basic tools. I think people can start doing SVV. I think that's really low cost to get into as an additional measure. So for instance, the girl who had really good balance on SOT, who was a ballerina, still had an impaired SVV.
Right.
So that was something that we were able to actually show her was impaired, even though based on our clinical norms, her balance is fine. Bucket test is pretty cheap.
Yeah, we should all get buckets.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, or you can do like I do. I have expensive goggles and stuff from Switzerland that I use. It's more fun.
Oh, I think the data you get from those things is definitely better. And if you have the means to get those things, it's definitely better for your patients. I just don't think every single person has to go through those.
No.
I don't think a clinician needs to say, oh, if I don't have goggles, I can't do anything about the vestibular system.
Right. Although, but this is me being a clinician working only in vestibular the last 14 years. Because we know from your data and vestibular agnosia papers that concussed patients talking about dizziness, that it's difficult for them to really feel what's going on. So that might be a way of actually interpreting your own symptoms in a wrong way. So it's been hypothesized that if you, for instance, have a BPPV, loose crystals in your ear, that you actually might not feel them the way a normal or unconcussed patient would. And then you would need some kind of gaze limiting goggles to establish whether or not the nystagmus is correlating to BPPV or something else.
Definitely. And I agree completely with that. I think I'm speaking more in just like a general, from the average concussion patient.
Yes.
For those sorts of more specific vestibular diagnoses, those tools are really helpful.
Yeah. I tend to stress that a lot.
That's why I don't want to steal your thunder because you're absolutely right.
No. All right. I think, one last thing. I read in your paper that latency of saccades was also an objective finding that suggested that you could diagnose a concussion. Is that correct?
Yeah, so that was the second paper from the college athletes that looked just at our ocular motor data.
Yeah.
And that could be related to the visual system. It could also be a cognitive thing. So right. We don't really know, you know.
But how much of a latency did you find on average?
Yeah, so that if you actually look at the data, so our eye tracker is 100 hertz. So you can only look at differences of 10 milliseconds between them.
Mm-hmm.
And the non-concussed group was like 180 milliseconds, and the concussed group was like 200 or 210. I don't remember the exact number.
Okay.
So they're pretty close and statistically different, but unless you have some really fancy eye tracking data, you're not going to be able to see those differences in saccades.
No, it's impossible to see them with your own eyes, I guess.
Oh, yeah, you're definitely not seeing them with your own eyes, but...
But is it possible to put this into a cheap test, or is it of no function to actually test saccades in the concussed patient?
So it's a really good question. So people do use like the King-Devick test, and that kind of gets at that, because over time, if you have to make 100 saccades for the test, that 10, 20 millisecond difference actually ends up being a full second, right? Of difference. So there are people doing that as sort of a functional measure of saccades, or people doing like iPad tests where you have to, you know, click the button that lights up. I don't know if the actual eye movement is enough.
No.
I think if you have a functional test of it, it's something.
Yeah, exactly. You need to put it into a system so that it adds up, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah. Graham? This has been a pleasure from our side. It was
it's been great. Thank you so much.
Really good of you to say yes when we asked.
I mean, so I finished my PhD in the middle of a pandemic, and I haven't been able to share the work with anyone. And it's really exciting for me to hear clinicians interested in my work, because that's really my goal. I want to be a clinician scientist. And so hearing people who are actually seeing patients and actually working with them, hearing my research and thinking it's interesting or relevant to their patients is really rewarding for me. And I'm really honored that you asked me to talk with you.
So you're cool. Bringing knowledge further. We love it.
Yeah. Thanks so much for spending your time with us. You probably have busy days at med school now, but...
You're running to another presentation in like 40 minutes, aren't you?
Yep. In 10 minutes, I had to jump across to the other one, give a presentation on basically what we've just been talking about. Yeah. Luckily, I have this week. It's not really off. I'm on a research elective to finish up a book chapter I was working on.
Okay.
But I get married on Saturday. So I've got a lot going on, not academically, but a lot of other things going on. So
good luck with life. Good luck with research. Good luck with everything. Thanks again for joining us on this podcast.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. It's been a real pleasure.
Hei, dette Narve fra Skallebank. Har du ris, ros eller spørsmål, så setter vi pris på at du sender det til skallebankpod@gmail.com. Du kan også følge oss på sosiale medier under Skallebank Hjernerystelse. Det finner du både på Instagram og på Facebook.